Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Howard Crosston is not only an incredible fisherman, but a super nice guy. As part of Team England, he has fished in 13 World Championship events, finishing in the top 10 five times with an average of about 150 anglers. He won Team Gold in 2009, Team Bronze in 2014, and placed an individual fourth in 2012, an individual 10th in 2017, and took first place as individual world champion in 2019. He has been with Hardy Fishing for 19 years and has served as the Hardy Global Product Manager for the past 10 years. In this episode, we review Howard's best strategies for an everyday angler as we title the podcast, Competition Tips for the Everyday Angler. I want to congratulate all the winners from the Fly Fishing Show Consumer Choice Awards. With over 40 categories, visitors from the Fly Fishing Shows and consumers online voted for their favorite products, and the winners were just announced. For a full list of winning products, check out flyfishingjourneys.com under News or in the search bar for Consumer Choice Award winners.
All right, guys, so as you can hear, that's an incredible resume, and we're so excited to have Howard Crosston here on the podcast. Howard, thanks for taking a few minutes for us.
Thanks, Rob. Good to meet you.
Wow. World champion in 2019. Where was the World Championships located?
Yeah, so 19, we were in Tasmania, an island off the coast of Australia, part of the Australian mainland. So, yeah, awesome experience.
I heard there was some wind there that year.
Well, you know, you could say that. I mean, I'm getting a bit of a reputation for taking the weather with me. You know, I've brought the rain with me to the US this time and the snow, but in Taz I definitely took the wind. It was serious, yeah.
So, as we've heard, you've been a competition fly angler for many years. You've been part of the Hardy for over 19 years now. Why don't you tell our listeners where you're from, Howard?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Manchester, England, which, to be honest, didn't have a great amount of trout fishing in the immediate locality. But my parents had a holiday place up in the northwest of England in the Lake District. Really good fishing up there. And so I sort of split my time, you know, through the week. I was down in Manchester, but up at the weekends and holidays, I would be up in the English Lake District fishing literally every single weekend.
So Manchester, huh? Manchester, England.
Yeah.
Manchester United or...
You know,
too, I got 50-50, I got it wrong, right?
Too busy fishing to follow the football.
Okay, well, yeah. You're very unique then.
Yeah, 100%.
Now, Simon Gosworth's from that area, I don't think too far from...
Yeah, Simon was a little bit further south.
Okay.
I've known Simon well for a long, long time, so, but he lives over here now, so...
Do you ever get to fish with him, or...?
I've never fished with Simon.
Okay.
Never had the chance.
So, this is actually fantastic, so I'm so glad we have you here, Howard, because with your competition experience, we're going to bring a podcast today for our listeners that's titled Competition Tips for the Everyday Angler. But before we get into those competition tips, because I know we want to hear them, I want to talk a bit about your backstory. How did you get involved in fly fishing? You're there in England. You know, where did this passion come from?
All right. So basically, I lived down in Manchester, which was quite an urban area. When I was quite young, my parents got a holiday home that was in a really nice rural part of the country up in the English Lake District. And I started to fish in a river that was very close by, full of wild brown trout. Not the easiest wild brown trout to catch, but some of them were quite big. So I started to fish there really with my father and my uncle. And as I started to get more into it and started to fish more, I entered a few casting competitions, quite well at them, even quite young, sort of 12, 13, I won a few competitions. And then ultimately, quite a few years later, I was still fishing all the time and competition casting. I ended up in the World Fly Casting Championships in the late 90s, I think it was.
How old were you?
I was in my 20s.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a pretty tough school. I went up against the likes of Steve Ray, Jeff, and a few of the other, you know, great tournament casters. And I did okay, but it became obvious to me then that I would have to put in far more effort into the casting at world level, where you're not using fishing equipment, you're using just basically tournament equipment to do any good. So I sort of changed direction then, and I entered a river fishing competition because I like river fishing, and I thought that's an outlet for my sort of competitive nature. And I entered the first one, did really well. I actually won it unexpectedly, and that sort of set me off then on the path to, you know, trying to qualify for England teams and ultimately to get into the World Championships.
So was it a family member? Was it a friend? How did you kind of get involved in fly fishing?
Yeah, it's my dad and my uncle, really. Yeah. My dad, sadly, is no longer with us. My uncle is, and unfortunately, I don't fish with him anymore now. But those two guys really are what sort of got me really into the fishing and sort of kept me going and giving me little bits of snippets when I was quite young to keep me interest and, you know, learned a lot off those guys.
What were some of the, like, rivers or areas that you went fishing there?
So I was pretty much in the, what they call the English Lake District. So some of the rivers would be like the Eden, the Eamont, the Lowther, Dacre Beck, all of these kind of wild trout rivers, no stocking, a little bit of stocking in one of the rivers, but not very much, and nearly all wild fish, and challenging wild fish, not easy ones to catch. And that's really where, to be honest, a lot of the skills that I sort of use these days in competition fishing have come from that quite hard school. When I started young, it wasn't easy fishing.
So talk a bit about the connection between the history of fly fishing in England. Because England really is kind of what many would consider part of the foundation of fly fishing.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the home of fly fishing. You know, a lot of the, you know, the real great anglers have come, and a lot of the really great techniques have come from English anglers of the past, you know. And today, I mean, you know, everybody when they think of fishing in England thinks of the chalk streams, you know, thinks of that classic English fishing that's very expensive, hard to get access to, you know, a lot of rigid rules, you know, dry fly only upstream, etc. And some of that is true, you know. It is an expensive place to fish. It can be hard to get access to the water. And there are some quite stringent rules in place. You know, sometimes it's dry fly only up until 1st of June. But that's not the entirety of fly fishing in England. You know, if you go north, you then got, you know, big freestone rivers, even an odd river that could be classed as a tailwater, and miles of accessible fishing, low cost, and a lot of wild fish.
And how is it today? Is it? Can you compare the fly fishing opportunities today to back how it was in the past?
That's quite tricky. I mean, there's a lot of things changing. There's a lot of challenges today with some of the fishing. You know, we've got a lot of predation. We've got some problems with cormorants really exploiting the fish in the rivers and really reducing the numbers in some places. We have some problems with water levels. You know, the weather's changing a little bit and we're getting big floods, we're getting droughts, things are happening that didn't used to happen. On the flip side of that, some rivers that a number of years ago might not have been fishable, you know, because of industrialization and things like that, are in technically in better condition. There is some issues going on as well with water quality these days, with some changes in regulations, which is not a good thing in terms of, you know, releasing untreated water during high flood events, and there's a lot of controversy over that at the minute. But generally speaking, we have still got some very, very good fishing that's easily accessible.
Would you consider it still a destination location for people to fly into England and enjoy the fishing in the area?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, depending on what you want to do, you know, you could fly down into the south of England and you could be on the test within a couple of hours, you know, and experience crystal clear water, rising fish, big fish as well. The test got some really big fish in it. Alternatively, you could fly into, you know, Scotland or the north of England, and you could fish, you know, any of the big freestone rivers, again, within a day or so. I get fish on dries, nymphs, streamers, anything you want. And then, of course, for England, we've got lots and lots of exceptional lake fishing. A lot of our lakes have got big quantities of introduced rainbow trout, which actually grow on once they're in the lake. So, you know, they're putting in a pound and a half, but by the end of the summer, they're sort of 2.5-3 pounds. So,
wow.
Challenging fish, and there's a lot of them, you know, so it's really good.
How far is the test from, like, say, London?
Oh, you can probably be on the river within a couple of hours.
Okay.
You know, it's not a great huge distance away. For me, from where I live, to get to the test, 7 hours in a car.
Okay. Where do you live?
So I'm like on the, now currently I'm on the sort of northeastern side of the country, up towards the Scottish border, quite close to the head office of Hurdy, which is in Alnwick, England. So.
Before we jump back into the podcast, here's a short word from one of our fantastic sponsors. Are you a guide, a lodge, or a product manufacturer in the fly fishing or outdoor industry? I want to introduce you to and highlight Cross Current Insurance. Their entire team are great people and experts in their field. They have a guide insurance program that is amazing and very affordable. If you are a lodge or retailer, they also have programs tailored to your needs. These guys fish and are in the outdoors, so they know the industry and the landscape. To get more information on a program that's perfect for you, find them at crosscurrentinsurance.com.
So I actually came to your presentation, Howard, and what you talked about was 5 points for 5%. So we're going back to our theme here of competition tips for the everyday angler. And it seemed to me like these 5 points for 5% would tie in well as competition tips for the everyday angler. What does that mean, 5 points for 5%?
Yeah, so I mean, I've competition fished for a long time now, and I'm always trying to boil down what makes a difference. There's a lot of distraction, to be honest, when you're fly fishing. You know, we've got access to all these different kinds of equipment, all these different flies, all these different materials to make flies from. And really, although all of that stuff can help, it's really the key fundamentals that make a big difference to people's success. And those fundamentals can vary dependent on the situation you're in, but some of them always pretty much hold true. I mean, one of the big ones for me is around being organized. In competition fishing, we're fishing very time-pressured situations where we don't have a lot of time to do things. And being organized, having all your gear set out in a way that you can access it easily, things that don't tangle when you're using them, it's a really big thing. And I put a lot of time into how all of my equipment's set up and organized. Probably a little bit too much time, to be honest. So organization's a big thing. I also try and boil it down to just what I need. So, you know, I won't carry to the river, you know, 10,000 flies and four different lines and all of this stuff. I'll boil it down to what I think I'm going to need in that scenario. And that's an ever-evolving process, you know.
What I got out of your presentation is that, and I love it too, because I'm super analytical. And it sounds to me that you're very analytical as well. And you're almost pre-thinking everything that you're going to do on the river at your house.
Yeah, not so much at the house. I mean, what I would tend to do is, in a competition, we get some time to pre-practice. So we can scout the river, we can look at it, and we can fish in areas outside of the competition area. So I'll look for what I'm going to need in that event and in those beats whilst I'm doing that pre-practice. And I'll decide, you know, at that point, what kind of equipment I'm going to take, whether I need to take extra equipment to leave on the bank in case things change, or whether I can take a lighter approach. So all that pre-planning is quite an important part of it from a competition perspective.
Yeah, one thing you talked about is like the leader loops. Is maybe you talked about even snipping that loop that comes with your leader.
Yeah, so that falls under like the big category of refinement, really. And that's that sort of like a never-ending process, really, again. So refinement for me is, I try and make everything as smooth, as efficient, and as reliable as possible. So when it just comes down to loops on the end of fly lines, most fly lines you buy have got a welded loop. You know, the first thing I do is cut that thing off and throw it in the bin. Because it's a big, bulky loop that adds weight, it can jam in the guides. You know, it's not a great thing for having a smooth transition between leader and fly line. So I cut that off, strip the fly line coating off, double it back, whip a tiny, tiny micro loop in, as small as I can get it, super glue it, and that thing, when you tie leaders of varying types to the end of it, will just slide through the rings really easy. It's very reliable, and it's a lot neater and a lot more effective than a big welded loop on the end of your fly line.
Will that help your sink rate?
It's not really about sink rate in that instance. The whipped loop is typically so that we can change leader systems when we're fishing in the river quickly. I can change from a dry fly rig to a nymphing rig to a light leader to a heavy leader, depending on what I need to do.
Okay.
And with it being a small loop, it travels through the guides that much easier. And the other thing with it as well, when you're playing fish and you bring that connection through the rod rings, if you've got a bulky connection that rattles through the guide as you pull the fish towards the net, that's enough to throw a hook, especially a barbless hook, which we all use in the competitions.
Yeah. So it's really just about getting that, if you need 29, if you need 30... You can't have 29, you need 30.
Yeah, I mean,
you need that. You need to land that fish.
Yeah, it's all about it. Competition fishing is thin margins. You know, a lot of people think, you know, the best competition anglers in the world win with 10 and 20 fish margins. They don't. They used to a number of years ago,
yep.
But everybody's got better. It's a lot more competitive than it ever was. And the finest of margins now make a difference. I mean, the year I was lucky enough to become world champion, over the 5 days that I fished, I had three fish, which if any one of those three fish had lost, I would have been second. So it was down to absolute centimeters at the end of the day.
You talk about tippet rings and not to use them too big. And like sometimes you just grab a tippet ring and say, oh, this is easier to tie and I'm going to go with the bigger one.
Yeah, that's it. Tippet rings are really popular and they're a good way to attach tippet to a leader. The problem is most of them that say on them 1.5 millimeters are not 1.5 millimeters, the way bigger. You can get some now which are tiny. It's a true 1 millimeter ring, and I tend to use those because they're just a lot neater and they're a lot lighter. That's the main thing. Anything on that nymphing leader that is weight, that is added weight, can interfere with your contact, even a tippet ring. When you're fishing very, very light, tiny little flies with small beads or a bit of lead, even a tippet ring hanging on the leader can negatively affect drift and contact.
What about a setup? Now let's talk about your like a Euro rig setup. I'm sure you not up make all your own leader setups and you have your own formula. And how long do you like to fish a Euro leader?
Yeah, so for what you would call what's now become known as Euro nymphing, which is really Euro nymphing's a catch-all term. It covers a lot of different styles and they're not all the same. But the one that's most commonly practiced now is tight line or contact nymphing.
Yep.
That's how it's commonly sort of referred to in the US. And that's a version, it's actually a French, technically a French method, but it's often referred to as Spanish nymphing. There's a lot of crossover. I'm not going to get into why it might be called French and why it might be called Spanish.
I couldn't get that answer out of Devin Olsen
I mean, I know guys on both sides of the border. And
no need to cause an international incident.
Yeah, I need to go back to both countries fairly regular, so I'm not going to get into that. But the leaders we use now, typically, and the leader I use most of the time, is actually totally level. It's got no taper in it or very, very little taper. And under the rules, we can only use a leader that is 2 times rod length in total, including tippet. So if I'm using a 10-foot rod, the leader's 20 foot from the end of the fly line to the last fly on the cast.
Now, fly line is just like the straight mono fly line, or what are you,
Yeah, level, thin level.
Thin level line.
European nymphing line. It's in there because the rules that we fish under are there to ensure that it's still fly fishing. So we've got to have a fly line of sorts. You can't really cast it very well.
Yep.
But it's just there. It's better to handle, so it's nicer when you're fishing with it, and it has got a little bit of mass to it. So if you want to throw a little bit further, you can use the line a little bit.
Now, some people aren't you. Like, if you're not competition, some people have done away with even that line. They're just using mono, right? Or
yeah, if you're not in competition, there's a lot of people just use a reel full of mono and put a leader on the end of it. There's nothing wrong with that. For me personally, I know I'm really splitting hairs here, but for me, I'd feel like that's a little bit of a step too far away from, you know, having some form of fly line.
Fly fishing.
Yeah. Yeah, so I prefer to have the thin Euro line.
You got your level line and you have a 20-foot leader.
Yeah.
And you say you're pretty much the straight...
Yeah, I'm straight through because taper is weight. So if you start heavy and taper down thin, you've got weight in the back end of the leader. And although it might not seem much, if you're throwing a relatively light fly, let's say you're throwing a fly with a 2 millimeter bead, and you throw that in the river on a tapered-style nymphing leader, and you elevate the rod, you will see a sag from the end of that European nymphing line right down to the fly, caused by the weight of the leader. If you do exactly the same thing with a thin, level-type leader, something with a diameter of anywhere between 0.18 and 0.14 millimeter, you'll see a much straighter line to the fly, a much more direct contact.
What X is that?
I honestly do not go off X. I just go off finite measurement, actual diameter, physical
different
diameter.
Companies are different X's and
you
stuff.
See a lot of stuff wandering around, and you know, and I check a lot of stuff as well. I measure it to make sure it is what it should be on the packet.
Okay, so you eventually get down to what I would call a 6X or a 7X or something super thin.
Yeah, the main lead is generally not 7X. It's normally a little thicker than that. But then on the front end, the tippet, that might be 7X or 8X.
Right, but up above that might be like a 1 or 2 or something like that. Or
yeah, it's usually, for me, it's usually typically a little bit lighter than that. But it's, I just, like I say, I just go off them pure diameters and I carry everything from 0.28 right the way down to 0.14. I never go any thinner than that. So it's like...
Now 0.14 would be at the fly.
That's where the tippet then comes in. So typically, if you did it in pounds breaking strain,
right,
the main leader might be anything between, let's say, 9 pounds and 5, so it could be in that,
okay,
in that range. And then the actual tippet material I'm using would be anything between 4.5 and 2.5 would be the tippet material.
Basically on your entire rod you have like 2 or 3 different sizes.
Yeah, so the actual, my leader construction would be, so let's say I'm using a 10 foot rod, I would have probably in the region of about 15 feet or a little bit less, actually, of level line.
Yeah.
Now, I will sometimes tie that level leader with different colours in it. So although it's the same diameter, the colour changes. So I've got the back end section is two colours. It'll be like pink and yellow or white and pink.
Your indicator stuff.
Yeah, and that's at the back end for a reason. And then I will have a clear section, which is maybe like 12 inches. And then at the front of that, I'll normally have a white section, which will be a couple of feet maybe.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why, although it's all the same diameter, the reason why it's in three colour breaks is that when I'm nymphing, and because it's so thin, I can allow that to drop through the water column if I need to get deeper without re-rigging the tippet. So I can let that leader go in deeper. But what I need is a break in the colour to be able to indicate or see the take on a colour change. So I'm manufacturing, I'm building in colour change into the back end of the leader.
So like little strike indicators in there.
Yeah, basically.
That's super cool. And then you get down to what we call a point fly or your first fly?
Yeah, I mean, usually I tend not to fish more than two flies now, and a lot of the time I fish a single fly.
No kidding.
Yeah, even nymph fishing, I'll fish single fly a lot of the time.
I kind of like that, too. You get these knuckleheads talking about three flies, and I'm like, no, thank you.
Well, you know, three flies, there's a place for it, you know, and that's a Czech method. So, you know, those guys are some of the best anglers in the world, and that's a thing over there. And we use three flies quite a lot in the UK when we're grayling fishing. But for me, I prefer two, and if I can fish one, I often will. Because the reason being, it's more precise. You have better contact to a single nymph than you do to two, because that top dropper can isolate your contact from the point fly a little bit. And it, for me, it makes me, especially in a competition, it makes me fish more thoroughly. I tend to fish better when I'm fishing in a one fly scenario.
That's amazing. I love that. That's a unique tip right there. Because I like one fly too, but it just always seemed to tie too, because that's what you're supposed to do, right?
Sometimes
you need the weight to get down too.
Oh yeah, and there's plenty of tactical reasons for using two. Sometimes I'll have a much lighter fly up on the dropper, and it's got a lot more action in the current, and that sort of drifting, floating motion as you're fishing it is what you need to catch more fish. You can't draw hard and fast rules in any of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are, to some degree, all generalizations.
Well, we kind of, I veered you off of our topic here a little bit, which was competition tips for the everyday angler, and I wanted to get a little bit of your in-depth knowledge on Euronymph setup, because I have you here. So going back to the everyday tips, you talked a bit on your presentation about attacking that water, and maybe you only have 2 hours to fish your entire beat, and you're not going to be able to fish at all.
Yeah.
So you have to be very particular about how you make your cast, how you locate maybe your first fish, and then how you attack the rest of the river based on that information.
Yeah. When you assessing a beat or assessing a section of river is a key skill in competition. You have to be able to read water well, and you have to be able to read it quick. Now, the good thing is that trout the world over typically like the same kinds of places and the same kinds of things, so there's a lot of crossover. All you've got to really do is work out whether there's anything that's peculiar to that venue or that destination that you need to allow for. But typically when I get to a section of river, I'll look at it and I'll identify the air water, so the best places where the fish are most likely going to be. Then I'll look at how much air water there is, and I'll balance that against how much time I've got to fish and what I'm sort of looking for in my head as a number of fish I need to catch. And then I'll draw a plan out from that. Now, the biggest mistake most people make is that if that plan does not start to go according to plan, is they tend to either start panicking or just keep hammering away doing the same thing, rather than reassess and start to try and replan to sort of recover the session and try and get back on track.
You know, a lot of times, like, we'll just look at a pool and be like, wow, that pool looks super fishy, and I'll fish it for 3 hours, and, you know,
try
to get your one, your two, your three, or whatever.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with doing that when you're pleasure fishing. You know, the thing with competition is, it's, you know, if I just pleasure fished, right, I would go and I would probably fish the same way, you know?
Yep.
But when it's competition and I'm doing it to, you know, to beat other anglers and to catch as many fish, and I'm challenging myself as much as, you know, it's a challenge to catch the fish. For me, getting those extra few fish, even if the small fish, right, even if they're not particularly big fish, is a real big adrenaline rush
Yeah.
compared to just fishing, you know, for pleasure. you know.
Well, Howard, I think a lot of times in the mindset of that either new Euro angler or that contact nympher, or if I'm throwing, you know, beads in a nymph, and with a strike indicator even, so many times I see anglers, they're trying to think they need to get that perfect drift over that perfect spot.
Yeah.
So they spend like 15 casts just to get maybe one or two or three of these drifts that they qualify as a trout, you know, trout worthy.
Yeah.
So we spend more time on this one spot. Maybe you're saying, yeah, make a few drifts, but spend more time moving around and assessing your bead a little better.
Yeah, in some situations, definitely. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm quite fairly ruthless in the way that I fish when it comes to targeting a particular lie. So if there's a lie, and I look at that piece of water, I think, right, there's going to be a fish there. What I'll typically do is, if I'm contact nymphing a uro-nymph, let's say I'm fishing a single nymph, I'll put the fly in there, and I'll give them, if it's a particularly good piece of water, I'll give them two or three good drifts with no drag to see if they'll eat it. If I don't get a take off them two or three drifts, I'll put the fly in and I might give it some animation. So I might jig it or I might sweep it slightly, especially when it's getting to the point where I think a fish might be sitting. If I still don't elicit a response from that fish, I don't get into the sort of downward spiral of changing flies.
Okay.
I'll typically move up the river and I'll target the next lie. But what I will do is, when I'm starting to target that lie, I'll turn round and I'll typically throw downstream to the previous lie. Because what happens sometimes is, you know, everybody thinks that perfect dead drift is what the fish want. And it isn't always that case. Because until you catch a talking fish, you're never going to know what they really want and why they want it.
Sure.
You know, and a lot of times, for no discernible reason, making the fly do something that the fish is not accustomed to, either swinging it across the fish or fishing it down at a different angle, is enough to make them eat it. Now, sometimes it can be a case of they haven't seen it when you're fishing it normally, and by changing the angle, you get a better presentation, they do see it. But other times, animating the fly is what makes them eat it.
One of the things you had talked about, and I put a question mark next to this, is you said lighter flies, more takes.
Yeah, so typically for me, if I'm fishing in a pressured situation where the fish are seeing a lot of different things, right, and they're getting caught and they're taking flies and they're getting pricked, hooked and lost, sometimes just going lighter so that you do get better drift and you don't get a fly that's just plummeting down through the water column will elicit more takes from the fish, particularly in the sort of, sometimes in a feeding situation where they're accepting stuff that's coming down the current, getting that better drift and that better drag-free drift is more important. So lighter flies, fished more naturally, will often elicit, not only elicit a take, they'll elicit a stronger take or a better take, you know, something that's more hookable, rather than, you know, a very quick interception and a spit out, which they can do sometimes.
So am I... You know, a lot of times you use the terminology bounce bottom.
Yeah.
Am I trying to bounce bottom or am I trying to keep my flies off the bottom or, like, in that region?
So this is where it gets a little bit, you know, some people, when they contact nymph or uro-nymph or whatever, the default method for a lot of people is what I would term as excessive weight. They would put a lot of weight on to get down on the bottom, and they're utilizing the weight to control the drift and control the fly. That is not particularly a natural presentation. You know, you're slowing everything right down. The flies are tethered on quite a tight leader, and you're eliminating some of the good qualities of a nice drift by doing that. It's slightly different when you're grayling fishing, which I might cover in a little bit, but when you're trout fishing, for me, you know, excessive weight can take away a lot of your takes. You don't get quite often as many takes as you would expect if you're overweight.
So sometimes a little lighter fly, more takes. I get it. You talked about rod swing, and that seems like almost like a typical contact, like a very much a contact fishing, and you're not almost even doing any bad cast, you're roll casting, and you're fishing the same kind of piece of water. What do you mean by rod swing?
Yeah, so rod swing is a term that I'm not going to say I invented it, but I've not really heard too many other people use it, but I sort of split my nymph fishing into two categories of execution is probably the best way. One of them is inside rod swing, and one of them is outside of rod swing. And all that means is, when I'm fishing inside rod swing, I'm fishing with a fixed length of line that is no more than around about 18 inches overall length longer than the length of the rod. So basically what that means is, if I swung my flies towards myself, the fly would swing to me and I would be able to catch it in my hand, right? So now I'm fishing inside rod swing, and I wouldn't lengthen or shorten that length of line. And what that allows me to do is, when I'm fishing, I can fish with my left hand, either with the landing net already in it or the landing net on my back. And that means when I hook a fish, there's always a few seconds of disorientation, even with a big fish, where you can quite often bundle them in the net before they know what's happened. And that means the fish is landed quicker, it goes back faster in better condition, and from a competition angler's perspective, you land it quicker.
So is your finger like on the line and taut and holding it that exact same distance all the time inside rod swing?
Yeah, I have the drag on the reel set so that if a fish takes off, it can take line and doesn't break me. But I trap the line under my rod hand finger. Left hand goes on the net. And if I hook a big fish, you know, I let go of the net or don't detach the net at all and play the fish normally, you know. If I have the opportunity in them first few seconds of hooking the fish to put it in the net, I put it in the net.
So what my question is making that cast with your hand tight on that line. Are you just basically just dropping it in, fishing it? When it gets to the end of the drift, you're just basically picking up and putting it back where you want it?
Yeah, pretty much.
And your finger never leaves that line?
Never leaves it. I don't do any line manipulation or anything. I'm fishing with a fixed line.
Yeah.
So, and it's similar to Czech and Polish style fishing, where they originally fished short lines. It's the same method. That's a European nymphing technique, you know?
Okay. I'm telling Devin, you're giving me a little bit more of what I'm looking for. So, by the way, you talk a lot about net placement. You had mentioned net placement. A lot of times I see the competition style guys, whether in person or online, and that net's always like right there. And so, you know, me, sometimes my net's in my sling pack or in my back or over on the bank.
Yeah, that's it.
So, you know, you see this same style of net carry for a lot of competition anglers. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I think Lucy thinks that I've basically lost my mind, because the amount of time I spend, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, but walking around the house with my gear on, detaching and reattaching my landing net, particularly before a big competition, is just ridiculous.
Wow.
Because I've always been a little bit weird about landing net placement. Over the years of watching a lot of competitors, even very good ones, the number of fish that you see lost because people can't detach the net first time or get the hand to it first time and have it come off clean. And then, more importantly, actually, get it back without having to mess around trying to line up two magnets. And, you know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's when you break off your fly because it catches on something. And
yeah, it's just, but net placement for me is massive. And, you know, the way I fish, I've got two magnets on the net. I have three magnets on the pack. So I can rig it in slightly different ways dependent on what I'm doing. And every single one of them, the main thing for me is every single one of them, when I put it back, it's got to go back first time, grab the magnet. And that takes quite a lot of messing around with to get 100% right.
So you're not carrying it on your back. Is it more on your side?
No, so I have one over on my left shoulder, which holds the net with the handle up. And it holds it like that so I can kneel in the river without pushing the net off my back. So if I have to kneel down to fish, I don't detach the net every time I kneel. So that's the main way that I would carry it. And if I've got a fish on, I'll go and pull it off my back a bit like you would pull a sword out of a scabbard on your back, for want of a better description. The second way that I'll do it a lot of the time is I have a magnet under the front of the pack that actually holds the pan of the net a little bit like a line tray in front of your body. And it just sits there already deployed effectively. Now, I do that for two reasons. The first one is, you know, if the fish are coming fast and furious, it's much easier to just detach that net when it's right there next to your hand and net the fish. Another reason, and it very rarely happens, but if you have a fish and it's jumping towards you, sometimes you can get that net and you can get it in the net while it's still airborne. And then the last thing is, if you're fishing a longer line method where you're moving upstream and you've got to manage slack line, you know, it acts like a line tray, like a stripping basket.
Yeah.
So everything drops into the net, so it doesn't go around my feet, it doesn't go around the grass.
Do you have a specific model or a brand of net that you recommend for this type of stuff?
You know, there's loads of decent ones out there, but I still like to make my own out of parts, I'll be honest.
Oh, come on, Howard.
I know, I could buy a manufactured one, but I like to, because the other thing is, right, in competitions, they're always messing with the rules. So when we go to some of these foreign countries, they put in rule modifications, and they'll change the allowable length of the landing net.
Okay.
So I use a carbon fiber, long carbon fiber pole, which I cut down to length. I use a screw-on head of varying sizes, and I have a number of different net heads with different grades of mesh. So if we're fishing a venue which is like really high, strong water volume, you know, where you've got really powerful, fast water, I have a net with a much bigger mesh so that when I go to net a fish, it cuts the water.
Interesting.
When it's a lot of small fish, I have a much smaller, finer mesh, which doesn't tend to tangle flies as badly, and with smaller fish they don't tend to get as tangled in the net. So I have different meshes dependent on what I'm doing.
Are there brands of mesh that our listeners could find, or
I'll be honest, what I tend to do is because of my job, I work in the fishing tackle industry, I've got access to a lot of different products.
Oh, even off market stuff.
A lot of different brands.
Yeah.
So I tend to, the one I currently use, I use the Graze. It's one of the rubberized meshes that we use on the coarse fishing landing nets.
Yep.
for fishing in the UK for whitefish.
Sure.
I tend to use the mesh off one of those a lot of the time.
We're going to take a short commercial break to hear from Tim O'Neill of Norvice.
What makes the Norvice different than another system?
There are a lot of rotary fly tying vices out there. The Norvice is the only vice that will truly spin when you tie flies, and there's a big difference between rotating a vice slowly and spinning it at a bit of a faster RPM. And being able to spin the hook on a zero axis rotations opens up a lot of doors for us in the world of fly tying.
Tell me about the introduction of colors to the Norvice system.
When we obtained the company from Norm, he said to me just a very, very short statement. He said, you know, I always thought a colored Norvice would be a cool item. We brought out five colors: Radical Red, Sunset Orange, Shamrock Green, Liberty Blue, and Royal Purple. We have five colors along with the black that you're accustomed to seeing with Norvice, and we've been doing very well with those.
To find more information and their online store, visit nor-vice.com.
You had mentioned you're a thermometer nut, reading temperatures.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always taking the water temperature.
What are we looking for when we take a temp?
It's really that sort of like golden sort of number where the fish become more active, you know. And that water temperature can vary so much through the day. But when it gets up into that sort of low 50s plus and you're starting to get into the range where the fish are getting more active and they're moving into some of that faster water to take advantage of the available food supply, that's when you start to look at it and think, right, you know, I'm going to get more chances now and I should probably be in this kind of water versus some of the slower, deeper stuff, which they might be in when the water's cooler. I have to say, I know that the temperature thing, and talking to Devon and listening to some of Devon's presentations, and he's got a biology background, I don't know what I'd say it's a hard and fast rule. I'm sure from his perspective it probably is. Sometimes in the UK, and it's a little different, but particularly with grayling, we see some really weird things that grayling do in relation to water temperature. And we've seen them in the middle of winter in stone cold freezing water in possibly the worst place they can be, which is like really fast shallow water and mm-hmm. the catchable.
Yeah.
Now, other things could play into that rather than insect activity, because, you know, grayling sometimes will follow spawning Atlantic salmon into shallow water.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're predating on eggs that are drifting down in the current. And later on in the winter, we even occasionally catch them and they've got salmon flesh.
Wow.
from die-offs, you know.
Yeah, Devin was very, like you had mentioned, with his biology degree, he was very in tune with, and I'm sure you have your numbers as far as like the 55 or 58 or, you know, what they do, or maybe if it's a little colder, he's fishing this way because they're going to be more stable, they're not going to move around as much, but if they get up into that sweet spot, you can fish different spots because the fish are going to be everywhere. And
yeah,
I'm sure you have all that stuff for your competition thoughts and stuff.
Yeah, just based off years of fishing in different places.
Yeah, you know. But kind of fine-tuning in, like a brown might have a different sweet spot than a rainbow, might have a different sweet spot than a brook trout.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, normally we're fishing for Browns, rainbows and grayling.
Yep.
You know, it's very rare that there's anything else, except we fish for coarse fish sometimes as well.
Tell our listeners what a coarse fish is.
Oh, so pretty much it's like, from a UK perspective and in Europe, things like chub, dace. Very occasionally, I've been in one competition where perch and roach counted as well.
Yep.
So they're just like a silver fish.
Yeah, yeah, like
basically.
Non-trout or something.
A non-trout, non-salmonid, yeah.
One question I want to ask you is, how do they measure how many fish you catch in a competition?
So
somebody behind you watching?
Yes, yeah, so generally we've got a controller who's on the bank. He's there to keep you honest and to make sure that your fish are recorded properly. Really what they do is they have a drain pipe, a trough with a measure in the bottom. Submerge it in the water, get some water in it. Fish goes into the trough. It's measured to the nearest millimeter, and then that fish is released by the controller.
Every fish?
Every single fish is measured.
So you have to wait. You catch a fish, you have to do this process before you can start fishing again?
Yeah, and then you've got to sign the card, fish goes back. One thing from a fish welfare standpoint is, if that fish doesn't go back, so if that fish doesn't swim off healthy, you lose that fish.
Wow.
So that comes off your card. And typically, and in some cases, if whatever you're doing is harmful to the fish and the controller judges it to be harmful, he can scrap your score.
So all your fish?
He can technically take them all off of that session. So the onus is on the angler to ensure the fish is well cared for and it goes back safe.
Before we move on to the next subject here, Howard, I do want to ask you, and this is just totally off comp, just maybe even pleasure fishing, your top dry, your top nymph, and your top streamer.
Okay, well, that's fairly straightforward. For me, top dry would be a cul de canard. A cul de canard, yeah, of some description. Probably an upwing, or actually, no, I'll take that back. Probably a sedge pattern.
Cul de canard sedge?
Yeah. The reason being, it can work very well when there's caddisflies hatching, obviously. It's also a very good inducer of a take, so even if there's no caddisflies, fish will come out of the blue and eat it. If there's a hatch situation, and even if they're being quite specific to what they're eating, sometimes if you drift that big sedge over the top of them, they'll take it out of reaction. So it's a good fly all round.
I love that. Before we move on to the next one, can you put anything on that fly to keep it buoyant, or is the cul de canard all you will need to keep it buoyant?
So you need a desiccant of some description.
The shaky.
Yeah, shaky stuff, like a fumed silica kind of desiccant. To give you an idea how much of that I go through in a year, I've just bought, I don't know what to describe it as, an oil drum full of it.
No way.
Yeah.
And Lucy, I understand what Lucy's talking about.
Yeah, it's in the garage, so I don't have to. I can just keep refilling now without having to buy any in small bottles.
So you shaky quite a bit?
Yeah, use it a lot. I go through it a lot in the season.
And, well, good. Well, let's talk about that in a second. Okay, so the next one, top nymph.
Probably for me, top nymph, I like a quill. Quill-bodied nymph. I've got in my box, I've got a lot of quills, different bead colours, some with a red neck, some with a natural hair, sort of Herzia thorax.
Yeah.
But for me, a quill...
I like that.
It's got a nice, slim, tapered profile. It looks like a lot of aquatic insects.
That's awesome.
It looks like a lot of different things.
That's even better than just giving me a pattern, because it's a quill in many different patterns.
Yeah, just a strip peacock quill body. I like natural peacock quill. You can get synthetics out there, which are quite good. But I like the look and the taper of a natural strip peacock quill.
That's awesome. Top streamer?
I mean, it's probably the same as everybody else's. The thing is, a black streamer with some kind of coloured tungsten bead on the head pretty much works everywhere.
In the world.
It's, you know...
Yeah, yeah.
You throw it into anything from crystal clear spring creeks to, turbid freestone rivers.
Sure.
And it works.
Yeah.
You catch fish on it, so...
Well, as we heard in the beginning and in my opening, you're 19 years with Hardy, over 10 years as the global product manager. Tell our listeners a little bit about the Hardy brand.
Yes, I mean, first of all, I've been fortunate to work for Hardy for as long as I have, and I've held quite a few different jobs in there, but I've mainly always been centered around work on product. I've been the brand manager, I'm now the global product manager, but I sort of manage all of the fly product. We own a number of brands, Hardy, Grays, Fenwick, Fluger, Hen, and anything to do with the fly product in those brands, I tend to work on, including Shakespeare.
It's a huge, huge name you just mentioned right there. Like Hen, I mean, is a massive name in conventional tackle. I mean, one of the best reels for conventional tackle out there.
It's a huge brand. We're really fortunate in the fly fishing part of the business to be you know, part of such a big company with so many resources. You know, we do a little bit of pen and fly. It's not a lot. It's just a few models of saltwater fly rods.
Yeah.
You know, and reels and combos. But I work on all of that kind of stuff.
And then Shakespeare. I mean, goodness, you're not going to find a better or more recognizable, you know, entry level at the sporting goods fly rod than a Shakespeare.
No, and it's really good stuff at the price point. You know, it's really nice gear, and we've got a big wide range of it. But I tend to work on all the brands. I mean, obviously, my heart will always be with the Hardy brand.
Well, obviously, that is, you know, more of a refined product. It's, I don't want to say higher end, but it's definitely going to be for that refined angler who wants what they would consider to be the best out there. So what is unique, and I don't have any problem or apologies for talking about brand-specific stuff here because we're all gearheads, right? We come to the fly fishing shows. We want to know what the difference is between a Hardy or an Orvis or other rods out there or reels out there. So can you help our listeners understand what would be, not necessarily better, but what would make Hardy different than another higher-end product?
I think a lot of it with gear, I mean, there's a lot of good gear out there, right? From all brands, you know, there are still a few bad rods out there, but it's getting less and less all the time. Stuff's getting better all the time.
Yeah.
I think what you sort of buy into a lot of the time, particularly with some of the Hardy product, you're buying into, first of all, it's a brand with a huge history. It's our 150th anniversary. You know, we've been doing it probably longer than most other fishing tackle brands out there. In terms of what you get that's different, I mean, really you're buying in some respects some of my preferences in rod design, for argument's sake.
Yeah.
And what I always try and bring to the rods is fishability. Now, I know that's, you know, you can fish with anything, but I'm trying to always make the rod the best fishing tool that I can. Now, there's a lot of good rods out there that are great casting tools that you can bomb, you know, 100-foot cast out every single time, but they're not actually particularly good fishing rods when it comes down to tippet protection and line control and that. And, you know, every different rod designer for every different brand's got their own interpretation of what makes, you know, a good fishing rod based on their experience. So I sort of use my experience from, be it fishing in competitions, right through to saltwater fly fishing, which I've been very fortunate to do a lot with Andy Mail as well.
Yeah.
And I like to try and do is talk to anglers who are specialists in that kind of fishing.
Right.
So in my case, I'm based in the United Kingdom. So although I saltwater fly fish a lot, you know, Andy Mill lives and breathes it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we use Andy as the sounding board and the, you know, the check measure against everything that I do.
Right.
To make sure we're really dialing that product in.
Yeah, yeah.
To, you know, exactly what it should be for that specific market. And I think we do that very well on the whole. You know, I go and talk to, you know, some of the best spear casters in the world, people who are spear fishing day in, day out when I'm developing the spear rods, and we tie all that together. And then on the technical front, we're always looking at new materials, new resin systems, and being such a big company now and such a part of a big group of brands, our R&D access, what we can get to in terms of materials now, is probably close to second to none. The size of the company now.
Yeah, yeah.
We can put a lot of money into that kind of stuff.
I actually listened to a podcast with Andy Mill, and he'll go out chasing these sharks and trying to put this gear to the test. And actually what he said is, I'm trying to break equipment. I'm trying to fish it as hard as possible to break equipment to know what needs to change and what needs to get better. So he puts this stuff, he says you can't do that on tarpon because of the fight. It's not the same as on these sharks, which give this incredible, like, speed, hard-charging fight, and it just, they go ballistic. So he puts this Hardy equipment to the test in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky. I've done that a couple of times with him now. And the main reason it's so good is that when you go tarpon fishing, right, you get so many shots in a day. Even an angler as good as Andy, he's not going to catch 20 tarpon probably in one day.
Right.
You know, but with that kind of shark fishing, you know, you get so much action. It's all the time. They're coming at the back of the boat. You're getting a lot of hookups. You're fighting a lot of fish. And the big, strong, acrobatic fish, you can put a lot of pressure on gear. You know, we use it to test rod blanks, to test drag systems in reels, to do all these kind of stuff. Because if you push the gear as far as you can, you'll usually manage to find something that you can improve.
So if I fish, let's just say, a Scott, I know what that feels like. You know, I know what a Scott will give me. I know maybe what an Orvis will give me. is your feedback to the feel of a Hardy?
Most of the good feedback that I get about it is people say, that's my favourite fishing rod. Now, that might be different from the favourite casting rod, but fishability is a combination of everything.
Right.
It's a combination of being able to throw it as far as you need it to go easily, to control the line,
yep.
to set the hook, to play a fish, you know, without either pulling the hook out or it not being strong enough to play that fish effectively, and then be durable as well. The thing's got to be durable.
Last.
You know, so it's a combination of all of those things.
As we kind of get down here to the close here, Howard, as far as I'm thinking here is especially you being a competition angler, I mean, that tippet protection is everything.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Especially when you look at the, I mean, urine infin now has become a massive thing, right, in the US. When I first came over to the US and did a talk on urine infin, which was probably 16 or 17 years ago, you know, I got some strange looks. I'm talking about 10 and 11 foot rods, and there's people getting up and walking out the room, shaking their head, you know, because a river rod in the UK, in the US then was 9 foot five weight.
Yeah.
And now everybody over here is urine infin. Even so, I see a lot of the European-style nymphing rods that are made particularly good for it. You know, a good Euro nymphing rod has got a relatively soft, relatively limber tip that helps you project a light fly and a light leader accurately. It's got good recovery still, so that you've got control. The butt section of the rod is proportionately stiffer, so you can play even relatively big fish with it.
Yep.
And I see a lot of rods badged as Euro nymphing rods, which are just soft noodles. That
right.
are floppy and they've got no real strength in the butt section.
Overdoing the tippet protection.
Yeah, they just think it's a long, soft rod that can handle soft, you know, light tippet. It's really not that. It's a much more refined tool. A bit like a rod to cast a long distance is a more refined tool.
And you guys have a specific Euro rod or a couple different.
We've got quite a lot now. We've got a real range of European-style rods. From at the top end with Hardy, we've got the Ultralight LL. I actually used the prototypes of those in the World Championships in 2019. Those rods that I fished with in that competition, the guides were held on with sellotape. I didn't have time to get them fully built out before I got there, but there was no way I was fishing that competition without them. That's how good they were.
Amazing.
And then when you come down the price range, we've got Euro-style rods in the Grays range. Including, we've got a full combo now for less than $300, rod, reel, and line, the whole thing.
And what's Andy fishing for his tarpon?
Andy usually fishes, all the times I fish with him, he's fishing 11 weights and below. He never fishes 12 weights. He's throwing the Zane Pros, the one piece, and I think sometimes the four piece, but he's mainly a one piece guy.
One piece?
Yeah, we still do the one piece rods. 8 foot 10 inch, one piece.
How do you take it on a plane?
Yeah, you don't. So
you drive.
He's fortunate; he can leave them down there in the Keys or drive.
What if you're going to Belize?
We still do them in four piece. We do 9 foot four piece as well, and all the same models in the Zane Pro.
What do you recommend for a tarpon in a four piece? What weight?
I mean, obviously, I've been fortunate. I've fished with probably one of the best tarpon anglers in the world in Andy, and he goes with 11.
You need 11, huh?
Well, it just depends. I know he fishes 10 sometimes when he's been chasing records with lighter tipping and stuff. If I'm fishing for smaller fish, you know, I like a 10 as well when they're not that big. But if it's big fish in the Keys, I throw an 11.
I'm going down to Belize in April.
Awesome.
Yeah. Awesome. I never caught a tarpon, so it was my first.
Nope. Oh, perfect. They're addictive.
Yeah,
they're addictive. Took me a few years to get one, but they're addictive.
Howard, it's been an absolute blast to have you on the podcast. I appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with our listeners. Maybe we can do it again sometime.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Rob. It's been great.
My pleasure.
Cheers, man.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.